From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Coming up on Forum this morning, the FBI is investigating the motivation behind the attack on two military centers in Chattanooga, Tennessee, that left four U.S. Marines and a Navy petty officer dead. The gunman, who also died, was a Kuwaiti-born naturalized U.S. citizen who was also a citizen of Jordan. We'll get the latest on the shooting and discuss what qualifies as domestic terrorism and consider, in the wake of the tragedy, a recent controversial House of Representatives bill designed to extend anti-extremism programs. And we'll look, too, at the question of the ongoing federal prohibition against firearms at military facilities. All that's up ahead. And Forum is next after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to this morning's Forum program. On Thursday, a 24-year-old Kuwaiti-born U.S. citizen named Mohammed Yusuf Abdulaziz took the lives of four U.S. Marines and a Navy sailor and wounded three others in attacks on a military installation and a U.S. Navy facility in Chattanooga, Tennessee. The shooter, whose motives are still unknown, was killed by police gunfire. U.S. Attorney Bill Killian announced soon after at a press conference that he was classifying the violence as an act of domestic terrorism. That in itself has caused a good deal of controversy. What acts should or should not fall under the classification of domestic terrorism? And other issues, too, have emerged in the wake of this tragedy, including a $40 million piece of legislation of concern to civil libertarians, engineered by Texas Republican Michael McCaul, designed to expand the fight against extremism. We also want in this hour to discuss the ongoing divide over the prohibition against firearms on U.S. military bases. A lot to cover. We want to go first to Chattanooga, Tennessee, and welcome Rabbit Zilke, who is a reporter with WUTC in Chattanooga. And Rabbit Zilke, welcome to the Forum program. Good morning to you.
Thank you very much, and good afternoon.
Good afternoon. It is indeed in Tennessee. And I know that the community there has certainly been shaken up by this tragedy, the magnitude of it. It would be expected that they would be. And you now have, we should say, 30 FBI agents due to arrive today. There's going to be a full investigation. There is a full investigation, but there's, even at this point, kind of conflicting narratives because, as I said, motives unknown. At first, we heard a good deal about a trip to Georgia and that that may have been significant or integral in changing this young man and turning him somehow into a terrorist or a domestic terrorist, as Bill Killian defines it. We'll get into that whole question of definition. But at this point, there are stories coming out largely having to do with his family statements that he was depressed and that there were terrible things going on in his life. There's even been a diary, hasn't there?
Yes, it has, but they haven't really released a lot of information based on that. We do know from reports of people he went to school with and grew up with here in Chattanooga that he was a pretty happy-go-lucky guy and quite the comic, actually, until about 2 years ago. He did move away to Franklin, Tennessee, where he was working for a while. And when he returned recently to stay with his family, suddenly he had a beard, suddenly he was moody, and recently he actually had a DUI conviction that he was facing.
And it's also apparent, at least from what the family has said, that they were, well, seriously concerned about him and that they had been concerned about him, although his father ran into some questions from investigators as well a number of times, though he was exonerated.
Yes, they didn't find anything there to continue, and of course, now we've got diaries, we've got internet stories, we've got his blog. We have a lot of things that they're trying to piece together, but right now they're still calling it domestic terrorism because it was a lone wolf shooter Muslim.
What is your sense of, the Islamic community there's response? They have said they're in mourning. They have certainly condemned what occurred. There seems to be at least a strong attempt to show their concern and show that they are certainly not in favor or countenance in any way what occurred.
Well, Friday was the end of Ramadan, one of their highest holy days and celebrations. They canceled that completely and participated in a multi-denominational prayer meeting at Mount Olivet Baptist Church where people from all over the city, the governor, all sorts of people were here. And at one point, the president of the Islamic Society of Greater Chattanooga was speaking and asked all the Muslims in the room to stand up. There were more than 150 Muslims in attendance on what should have been their biggest celebration, and instead they mourned with the city. And the city responded by a standing ovation. We don't want problems with the Muslim community. We are a city that pulls together.
So this has not reared the ugly head of Islamophobia, in your judgment?
Not in our city. However, some of our visitors to the city are not quite as forgiving.
And what's your sense? I'd like you to define that a bit, if you could.
Well, we have, of course, Westboro Baptist Church is in place, and we've had other people come. Now, in some ways, it's been wonderful. There was a motorcycle rally with over 500 motorcycles that came and went the route that the shooter did. We have had pickup truck rallies, people flying the American flag, literally thousands of people coming to the city to mourn with us. But, of course, you have those extremists on the outside that think we should burn down everybody and get physical about this. No one from Chattanooga, as far as I can tell, wants that. Everybody wants us to just heal, come together, which we are. We're mourning together as a city. We're coining the catchphrase, Chattanooga Strong, as we come together and deal with this.
Rabbi Zilke with us again from Chattanooga, reporter for WUTC. There have been some suggestions that actually U.S. Attorney Killian, who labeled this domestic terrorism, had some connection. Was he a keynote speaker at the mosque, as has been alleged, do you know?
I believe he was. He was also one of the primary speakers at the initial press conference and has been speaking quite often. Now, they've gone back and forth on the domestic terrorism. At first they said yes, then they said no. Then Homeland Security, they came down and said, yes, we are classifying this as a terrorist attack. So, you know, you get into the definition, is this is a military target, can it be terrorism? You know, what's going on here? But because they believe it's just a lone attack, kind of following in the wake of the Boston Marathon bombers, individuals stepping out on their own with an individual jihad.
Well, they call that lone wolf, of course, but it's also in the wake of what happened in Charleston, South Carolina, and there was a good deal of flack about that not being called terrorism.
I think a lot of people are trying to define it based on the background of the individuals, and that's kind of hard to do. You know, you can't really, at least in my opinion, condemn an entire religion or people from a religion just because we have had issues with extremists in the past.
Again, Rabbi Zilke is a reporter for WUTC in Chattanooga and joined us this morning from Chattanooga, and we thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you.
Let me tell you who else is with us to try to at least come to some realization or some sense of why this was labeled domestic terrorism and what domestic terrorism is. And as I said, I also want to get into some other matters that are related. Faisal Patel is co-director of Liberty and National Security Program with the Brennan Center for Justice at New York University School of Law and joins us this morning from Washington, D.C. Good morning to you, or welcome.
Good morning.
Thank you for joining us. Let me also thank Farah Pandeeth for joining us. She is adjunct senior fellow with the Council on Foreign Relations and former first ever special representative to Muslim communities and is with us this morning from New York City. Welcome.
Good morning.
Good morning to you. And let me also welcome Seth Jones, who directs the International Security and Defense Policy Center for RAND, an instructor at Naval Postgraduate School in Monterey. Seth Jones, welcome to Forum.
It's great to be on. Thanks.
Glad to have you. And let me begin, Faisal Patel, with you. Let's try to work through this whole idea of what is or isn't domestic terrorism. It's really a weird area in the law. The FBI and Homeland Security funding is often dependent on what is or isn't domestic terrorism as well.
Right. So domestic terrorism is defined in different places in the law. Terrorism is defined in different places in the law. And the sort of two poles around which it's generally defined is an attempt to intimidate a civilian population or to influence government policy. But the thing that's interesting about U.S. law is that we don't actually have a specific federal crime of domestic terrorism. What we have is certain offenses which are labeled as terrorism-related. So airplane hijacking is kind of the classic example, or the use of explosives. And those kinds of offenses we consider to be terrorism-related. We also consider something called material support for terrorism, which is a relatively newly expanded offense that came about in the wake of 9/11, the expansion, to be terrorism. And then we have a host of things that have to have an international connection, right? Particularly material support for terrorism has to have some element of a support for a foreign terrorist organization. So unless you fall into one of these very specific categories of federal crimes, they actually can't charge you with a federal crime of terrorism. What can happen is that if somebody is convicted, say Dylan Roof is convicted on 9 counts of murder, at sentencing there is a possibility that his sentence could be enhanced as being a terrorism, because you are allowed to enhance sentences on the basis of connection to terrorism.
So in that instance, it's parallel to what hate crimes often carry with them.
Precisely, for the most part. Although, as I said, there are certain types of activities which are defined as being terrorism related. And obviously shooting wouldn't be one of them, because then you would capture, you know, a huge amount of activity within the definition of terrorism.
Well, Farah Pandit, there's a man named Fraser Glenn Miller who is now facing murder charges for allegedly killing 3 people in Kansas in 2014 in an attack on the Jewish Community Center there. Would it be different, for example, for someone like him who went in shouting Heil Hitler as opposed to someone who may have been shouting Abu Akbar?
So I think, I mean, you're asking some very important questions, and I think Faiza did a really nice job of explaining sort of the legal components of this. But I think that there's a larger conversation here about what we are talking about in America and how we think about these unfortunately too frequent events that are taking place with people who are claiming, in some cases, a particular ideology to inspire what they're doing. In the case that you talked about, I don't know it well, but certainly if he's pushing forward an ideology of Hitler, that is where he has been inspired. And the case is still out right now on what's happened in Tennessee in terms of what exactly happened to this young man to move him along a line into violence. And to do this murderous act. So,
well, forgive me, there are two, like I indicated to the reporter we had on earlier, two almost completely different narratives here. One is that he went to Jordan and became a different person after spending about 7 months there. And the other one, mainly from his family, is that he was spiraling downward and was using drugs, wanted to be a devout Muslim and so forth, but was falling and actually had a court appearance and was thinking about bankruptcy. All of these things, in other words, that were personal, not necessarily political.
So this is what we are, as we look at the issue of people who are getting radicalized, you're pointing your finger right exactly at the kind of complexity that we're speaking about. You can't put everybody in the same bucket and understand that only one thing is a trigger. As we look at the issue of ideology that's specifically happening around issues that are inspired by groups like ISIS or Al-Qaeda or the Taliban or other groups like them, we have seen over the course of 14 years since 9/11 a lot of research and a lot of understanding about that diversity of experiences that happen to young people that move them along the so-called conveyor belt towards radicalization. But there is one thing that is consistent with millennials, that is young people under the age of 30, that is the pool from which ISIS and others recruit. That is the first point. And the second point is globally, these young Muslim millennials are dealing with a crisis of identity. And that data point is central and very important to understand whether we're talking about a young person in Tennessee or we're talking about a young person in another part of the world.
Well, you mentioned Ramadan was mentioned, and there was certainly broadsides put out by ISIS and other groups that there should be, we should wreak all kinds of terror in honor of Ramadan. But getting to these motives, as you say, especially when they're so nuanced and complex and multidimensional, is really quite a task. And Seth Jones, let's bring you in here. Seth Jones directs the International Security and Defense Policy Center for RAND and is an instructor at the Naval Postgraduate School in Monterey. And I'm sorry about all of these losses, but we just found out recently that there was indeed a naval petty officer who died as a result of his wounds as well. Seth Jones, what's your take on this? I mean, we're talking about crime. We're talking about non-combatant targets versus military targets. How do we sort through all this?
Well, there's obviously a rich history of doing research and analysis on terrorism, and it's been going on for several decades and longer, actually, in the United States and overseas. What most definitions from academics and most of the government literature, and that's informed a lot of the databases that we've populated, whether it's the START one at University of Maryland or JANES or the National Counterterrorism Database or even the RAND MIPT one, generally defines terrorism as including a couple of key issues. It's ineluctably political in its aims and motives. It's violent, or at least it threatens the use of violence, and it's designed to have far-reaching psychological repercussions beyond the immediate victim or the target. And what you see, actually, in a range of these databases, including some of the government's own, is even within the United States, Based on those definitions, you have a range historically of right-wing terrorist attacks and groups, and including a range of neo-Nazi organizations like the Covenant of the Sword, the Arm of the Lord, the Order II. You have left-wing, which you might classify as left-wing groups, some of the extreme environmental organizations. You get ethnic nationalist terrorist organizations, and then you get religiously motivated ones. So, again, based on a lot of the tracking of it over the years, you know, some of these attacks, including the ones in South Carolina, based on the political aspect of that, the use of violence and the really the designation to have far-reaching psychological repercussions, that fits into almost any standard definition of terrorism. And again, let me just conclude by noting, I think as everybody here has said, this issue is very hotly debated, whether it's within government or within the academic community.
Yeah, well, speaking of the academic community, there's been an acceptance, and I think you kind of indicated it, of Nevin Bapat's definition, an academic from the University of North Carolina, who said noncombatant targets for political purposes. It does often boil down to that. But I wanted to get into also, a couple of other issues that have certainly become part of this, and we'll hear from our listeners about what really ought to be classified as domestic terrorism. But there's been a lot of concern, and let me begin with you on this, Seth Jones, about legislation that's been put through, a House bill that's been put through specifically by a Texas Republican by the name of Michael McCaul. It passed the day before this violence occurred and this terrible tragedy occurred. The legislation I'm talking about essentially would make for, the question is it counter-extremism or is it ethnic profiling? Even Congress can't seem to decide on this. It's $40 million to be spread over 4 years to essentially beef up monitoring groups, which many Islamic and Muslim and Arab American groups, as well as civil rights groups, think is going too far.
I think both within the United States and elsewhere, including in Europe, and this came out of the discussion in France, for example, after the Charlie Hebdo attack, domestic intelligence and law enforcement organizations in the U.S. and other locations, the Australians have said something similar, simply don't have the resources to deal with the threats that they consider to be acute. And this is not just religious organizations. This is right, left wing, other kinds of threats. My concern is that pouring more resources, whether they're used to hire more people to collect intelligence or to analyze intelligence, or even to conduct a range of community action efforts with local ethnic communities, it may be Muslim communities, it may be far right extremist communities. Just throwing more resources at this issue, I think we found since 9/11, will not essentially solve this problem. There are a lot of factors that are going into it. My concern is, are we actually doing the analysis to indicate what steps have been helpful and which steps have not been helpful in trying to get a handle on this problem? My concern is without doing some good analysis beforehand that leads us into how to spend the money, we're just going to throw it down a rat hole.
Well, there's also concern, Farah Pandith, and I'm speaking to you now as a former special representative to Muslim communities for the U.S. State Department, that the Muslim communities will be targeted.
And to that question, and also what Seth was saying, I mean, we are talking about the stopping of an ideology or the preventing within communities. And in fact, what we have learned along the way, I wish that there was more money that had been spent on soft power. We have not spent the money on soft power. And what I really want to underscore is that as we think about the solutions to push back against the ideology of the extremists, the answers must come from communities themselves. And the communities do not have money to be able to organically build out and scale up the ideas that they have. They are credible voices. Government is not a credible voice. So the first point I want to make is...
Wait, excuse me, before you make that first point, could you tell me what you mean by soft power?
Sure. When we look at how we generally deal with a terrorist threat, it's with what we call hard power. It's It's drones, it's boots on the ground, it's tanks, it's the conventional warfare that we think about. But what's happening with groups like ISIS and Al-Qaeda and other groups like it is that they have an ideological movement that is moving young minds, building virtual armies that are recruiting them ideologically, that move them into the physical armies. In order to stop the recruitment process from happening, you have to focus on the soft power. How are those young people getting recruited? What is happening ideologically? And government cannot be the ones that go into communities saying, don't believe this, believe that. You've got to get communities themselves to actually push back against foreign ideologies that are coming in. Toward that end, we look at that whole ideological space and the tools that you use to push back as soft power. And there has not been enough money that has been moved into the soft power space. That's the first point I want to make since 9/11. The second is this bill and the efforts that are happening on Capitol Hill to talk about this issue in a more expanded way is a very important conversation, and that is, where are we 14 years after 9/11? Where does the buck stop on the ideological piece? Who's actually running the show, and do we have enough people to be able to think about what's happening ideologically? And the answer is no. And so when Seth is asking these questions, he's right. You can't just throw money at nothing. But there has been a great deal of research that has gone into how people get radicalized and the kind of organic efforts on the ground by communities that can prevent the appeal of this ideology. And we need to spend more time on that, not just on the hard power. Mm-hmm. So I really think it's important that the American public understands the lessons that we've learned overseas around how this ideology is spread, because for millennial Muslims who are being targeted by ISIS, there is no difference between domestic and international audiences, and these digital natives need to be looked at very specifically, and given the communities need to be given tools to build resilience within those communities so that the young kids are not finding this ideology appealing.
All right, we are coming up on a break, but Faisal Patel, can I get you to weigh in on this?
Yeah, I mean, I think I actually agree much more with Seth, because I think that, yes, we should take lessons. And the research shows that there is no such thing as a conveyor belt of radicalization. There's no process that we can interrupt. There are no indicators that we can glom onto and say, aha, you know, Mr. X is doing such and such, and so that must indicate that he's thinking about becoming a terrorist. And so because we don't have that research basis, we are not as a society in a position to predict who's going to become a terrorist, just as we can't predict who amongst an entire population is going to become violent. To sort of start a program and to fund it based on these completely erroneous assumptions is really just asking for trouble.
All right, let me do this because we are coming right into a break here, and I want to give listeners an opportunity to weigh in here, talking about not only what's domestic terrorism, but also talking about what your views are on the question of extending anti-extremist monitoring in specific communities, which is really what this new legislation does. Our toll-free number is available to you. It's 866-733-6786. Join us at 866-733-6786 or email us forum@kqed.org. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. We are dealing with some major questions in the wake of the tragedy that occurred in Chattanooga, Tennessee on Thursday, the killing of four Marines and one naval petty officer, and talking about really how domestic terrorism should be or ought to be defined, what constitutes an act of domestic terrorism, but also asking a question in the wake of a Michael McFaul-sponsored bill, Michael McFaul being a Republican congressman from Tennessee, which would essentially extend programs in Homeland Security. Homeland Security did not necessarily ask for this, and there's controversy over whether or not they signed off on it, but essentially what it would do is extend programs against anti-extremists and do that by really looking at cohorts or communities, particularly in social media, that seem to, in many people's minds, be responsible for a lot of these lone wolf actions or mass shootings that are or aren't tied necessarily to ideology. Also, one other question that has emerged in the wake of this tragedy has been a question about whether or not those on military bases, particularly recruitment bases, should be armed. I mean, this is another tragedy that involves guns, of course. The shooter had a handgun. He had a couple of long guns and a rifle at home. But governor of Indiana, the governor of Florida have both come out and said at this point, National Guardsmen need to be armed and should be armed and will be armed. And there are other states that are seemingly falling in line on that. And there are many who feel, of course, that that is not appropriate. And so we get into that debate as well. We do invite your involvement in the program. And in fact, let me again give you the toll-free number, whether you're listening on radio, internet, or a Sirius satellite. You may indeed want to join the conversation or weigh in on the three threads that I'm really talking about here with our guests. The toll-free number again is 866-733-6786. You can also email us, forum@kqed.org, or post questions or comments right onto our website, kqed.org/forum, and click on this segment. And you can also, of course, tweet us. Our Twitter handle is @KQED Forum. Remind you that we're talking with Faiza Patel, who is co-director of the Liberty and National Security Program with the Brennan Center for Justice at NYU School of Law, with Farah Pandeep, who is an adjunct senior fellow with the Council on Foreign Relations and former first-ever special representative to Muslim communities for the U.S. State Department, and with Seth Jones, who is director of the International Security and Defense Policy Center with RAND, and an instructor at the Naval Postgraduate School in Monterey. Let me go to your calls, and we begin, Abdul, with you. Good morning.
Good morning. How are you?
Okay. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you. So I guess my comment very quickly is, you know, as long as the surveillance expansion goes to all the communities, all the extremist communities, even though I know that surveillance isn't effective at stopping it, you know, it may be okay, but the reality is that the last at least couple of years, last 10 years since September 11, all the surveillance has targeted the Muslim community. You know, I'm a veteran, and I know that the statistics here show that, you know, terrorists that claim to be using it in the name of Islam are the least, statistically speaking, amount of people killing U.S. In terrorist acts. It's actually other groups that kill more U.S. citizens. Wouldn't it be more effective to provide widespread education to the communities of how to spot people that have either psychological or mental troubles, how to see what the telltale signs and provide help to those communities? I mean, our expanded surveillance hasn't worked so far. Our selective targeting of the Muslim community isn't working in stopping domestic terrorism because they're not the majority of the terrorists out there.
Well, Farah Pandeep, let's get your take on this. This is a tough question about the divide between, again, the personal and the political.
Right. Thank you. And Abdul, thank you for your service to our nation. I do want to say two things. One is FISA talked about there being no indicators for who that potential terrorist might be. And she's right. But what we do know in terms of the research, and both Seth and FISA brought this up, was that, you know, the research that has gone into understanding how to prevent, how to build the resilience within communities. And there's a lot of work that has been done over 14 years to understand how powerful and how important communities themselves are in terms of pushing back ideology. And I say that because the bill does look to giving small seed grants to communities themselves. There's $6 million every year that is being looked at to go directly to communities to come up with ideas themselves. And that connects to what Abdul was saying.
Actually, there are a number of pilot programs that are going on along
there
the lines that
you just
outlined.
There are some pilot programs in our country, but there needs to be far more organically grown that come from communities. And what the communities are saying is that they don't have the funds to be able to do it. So, you know, you can't have it. It's a very complicated situation in terms of tainted money by the U.S. government. But the ideas to push back have to come from communities, and we need to do that. Abdul raises a really important question. And this is not just about monitoring. This is not about who are we watching? Because I think I testified on the Hill last week on this particular bill for 3 hours, if anybody's interested in how the committee went back and forth talking about what we mean by extremism. Of course we are looking at far-right extremism. Of course we're looking at all other kinds of extremism. But the fact that we're looking at right now vis-a-vis the Tennessee shooting and other lone wolf attacks that could be inspired by a global movement that's taking place on our planet right now cannot be ignored. And the idea that we are not actually understanding that Muslim millennials are at risk because, not because there's something wrong with them, but because the bad guys are targeting them and are pushing out and seducing and preying upon that demographic. And when you look at that fact, we have to build resilience out there that comes from communities themselves.
Well, there are community pilot programs, as I mentioned, in Boston and Los Angeles and the Twin Cities, and they have concerned civil libertarians in those local communities. In Minnesota, for example, where the programming is focused on the Somali community, Somalis have expressed distrust and wariness that authorities are essentially, you know, targeting them, and it's unfair and so forth. I'm looking at some emails here from listeners. Here, Shauna says, a Muslim shoots military personnel and it's an act of terrorism, while a racist shoots civilians in a church and it's just a hate crime. Seems to me the only thing required to be an act of terrorism is that the perpetrator be a Muslim. This is the kind of hypocrisy that's rampant in this country. Another listener writes, people in the throes of serious mental illness will often latch onto anything to give shape to their chaos. I don't know the particulars in this case, except that his parents said he was struggling with mental illness, but I think we give too much power to the terrorist to say that a crime like this was committed by a terrorist. Surely the act was terrible, but was it a perpetrator as a terrorist? And I think we seek easy answers, and in doing so give more power to forces we call terrorism. Better to examine mental illness and all of its manifestations and ramifications. However, it's hard to get away, Seth Jones, from the fact that he targeted military installations.
Well, there are a couple of things that are worth noting. One is when you actually look at the propaganda that's coming out of ISIS publications like Dabiq and even Al Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula publications like Inspire magazine, they're increasingly encouraging individuals through a range of social media forums, Twitter, YouTube. They're downloading videos, Facebook, to conduct attacks in the United States against soft targets, against police officers, against unarmed military soldiers. And so there is a strong push coming from a range of the propaganda to do these kinds of attacks. I think what has caused some concern, and again, there's not a lot known right now of the state of the investigation, but what has led some people to wonder about the motives of Abdulaziz was his comments that have been reported in a range of July 13 posts, saying that he mentions, quote, fought jihad for the sake of Allah. So there's in some of his postings, it has elicited at least questions. But I think for any of us not involved in the actual investigation right now, it's very unclear what his trip to Jordan. It's unclear what his internal communications were like. But I would just say, big picture, what we are seeing is a strong push from groups like Al-Qaeda and the Islamic State to do these kinds of attacks. And they do elicit very serious concerns about living in a society now where this is probably the new norm.
Let me go to some Facebook comments. We've been talking about social media. We actually asked our Facebook commentators about whether the Chattanooga attack should be called terrorism, and I'd like to get your response, Faisal Patel, to some of these comments. I'll just read a few of them. Samuel says, why not call it mental illness? Religion creates this message and embeds poor reasoning, not just Muslim, but all religion. If America was more open to helping those who are sick, it would be better dealt with as an issue of religion itself, as the true terrorist. And then Carol writes, these are the lone nut cases, perhaps bullied students who go postal in revenge. No on those being terrorists. This guy was Muslim and chose more than one target location, both military. So he had a message in mind and assume more details will be forthcoming as they dig into his computer and belongings. And Charles says it's Islamic terrorism committed by a citizen. However, I, unlike many, will not condemn all Muslims because of him. I wish you all wouldn't condemn all Southerners in our flag because one mental case shot up a church. Faisal Patel.
Well, I think a couple of things. One is we don't know if this was a mentally ill guy. We do know that in many of the kind of sting operations which have captured young Muslim men, you've had like a history of mental illness in several of them. But I will say that it's really, really hard, I think, to parse out an individual's motives for an act of violence. And we are looking at it with the benefit of hindsight. We're trying to put an analytical frame on something. We want to understand why somebody would do something that strikes us as being completely beyond the pale. It's like a normal human instinct. I think it's just there are no easy answers for an individual's motives, and it's not necessarily mental illness, though it may contribute to it. And frankly, it's not necessarily just a virulent ideology either. There are often political motivations, which we almost never talk about. There are personal circumstances, which we do talk about. But it's all these different things, and that's why it's so very difficult not only to pin down somebody's motives, but also to figure out who is on the edge of violence. And so one of the things that I wanted to mention was that the experience that we've seen overseas in these countering violent extremism programs, particularly in the United Kingdom, have been overwhelmingly negative. I mean, there's simply no evidence at all that the kinds of measures that governments have taken, whether it's putting money into communities or telling communities to try and identify at-risk or vulnerable youth have been effective at all. In fact, the UK's program has been opposed from the right because it's putting too much money into Muslim communities and because it's having the government work with organizations that the government finds distasteful for other reasons, and by Muslim communities themselves, which think it's simply a thinly veiled attempt at surveillance, which is not a surprising reaction, given that that has been the primary response of the state in the wake of 9/11 and the 7/7 attacks in the United Kingdom.
I think, as you are suggesting, I suppose in many murder cases, there are multiple motives, and it's difficult to get at a single motive or a monolithic motive. But I'm struck by also what you said about the UK, and I just want to get this on the record, because many of those who have been involved in violent incidents in the UK were actually citizens of the UK. They happen to be of Pakistani background in some cases, or of other Islamic backgrounds. And this young man was also, of course, a naturalized citizen. He was born in Kuwait. He was also a Jordanian citizen. But it's striking how many of these cases involve people who actually are citizens of, well, in the case of the UK or here in the United States, this young man. Let me get to more calls, though. I want to get to Sam. And Sam, thanks for waiting. Join us.
Hello. Thank you. You know, what I wanted to say to you is that the issues regarding terrorism and the growth of terrorism that we've seen in recent years are complex. The issues are complex, and I think you need to really to understand it so that you can find ways to counter it. You need to really look at all of the issues and put it in context. I'll give you a couple of examples. If you look at the situation in Afghanistan after the Soviet Union was forced to leave Afghanistan, the U.S., the Europeans, basically the world, forgot about Afghanistan. Everybody knew that there were problems in Afghanistan. But they ignored it, thinking, well, it's not our problem anymore. The Soviets have left, and let them sort it out in Afghanistan. But that created the conditions for Taliban and Al-Qaeda. And you can connect the dots and see what has what has happened after those conditions were created in Afghanistan.
You can also look at ISIS from the perspective of how we messed up in Iraq, because it had a lot to do with ISIS coming into birth.
Look at other examples where how terrorism has been dealt with. We remember the case of the hundreds of U.S. Marines who were killed in attacks by Hezbollah in Lebanon.
Yes.
And basically these terrorist organizations and the young people who are attracted to these ideologies, they basically see this as progress, as they're winning. And so as long as that's the case and the terrorist groups get away with it, you look at, for example, Hezbollah today even. You look at the crimes that Hezbollah is causing in Syria, the thousands of Syrians who've been killed by Hezbollah. And this is basically nobody's doing anything about it. So as long as that's the case, and these are just two examples, there are many more, I don't think you're going to solve the problem.
Sam, let me take your idea. I want to go to Farah Pandith on this because she's an adjunct senior fellow with the CFR, the Council on Foreign Relations. I think what Sam is talking about here is American inaction as being pretty culpable. How do you see it, Farah Pandith?
So you know, it's very interesting to hear that, because it's a, and it actually links to what Faiza was saying. Look, as the special representative to Muslim communities when I served at State, I traveled to 80 countries around the world, and I talked to tens of thousands of young Muslims under the age of 30 at the grassroots. And I absolutely do hear what Sam is saying. We do hear a conflation between U.S. foreign policy as the ecosystem from which a lot of this ideology grows. But it isn't the only thing that is manifesting itself in communities. There are a lot of triggers that happen ideologically for these young kids to understand, and we have to understand that in order to deal with this. So you can't just simply say it was because of the Iraq war, it was because of Abu Ghraib, it was because of Gitmo that we have ISIS. That is inappropriate and inaccurate. There are a lot of triggers that have happened. What is the ecosystem that's being built around the development of a Muslim monolith around the world? Where is that coming from? How are people thinking about themselves in that way? And this is, those are, when people talk about the complicated components to this, that's part of it. I wish it was so easy that one could say it's because of this particular foreign policy, or it's because America did this that we have that. It isn't that easy. This has been building over decades. And we have, unfortunately, a lot of things happening at the same time, including the trigger forward because of technology that's allowed a lot of these things to manifest. And so in a way that has at a pace and at a level that we haven't seen before, when we think about how we can combat this, how we can look at this issue, we must look at all of the different components to this, both the political, religious and other components of the ideology. But the piece that I really want us to understand is, when you're talking about the fact that government cannot, that this is something that has failed in the UK, or there hasn't been the ability for us to push back, let's be really clear. There have been many organic efforts that have happened that are showing promise and make sense. And it's not because the government has sponsored them. It's because communities themselves have come up with them. What we have not seen is the scale out and the sustainable scale out massively of these kinds of organic efforts that can see a change on the ground. So let's be really clear about what we're talking about, and not put everything into this, government is bad and they haven't been able to do anything. It's we have to be looking at how government can be the convener and the facilitator and the intellectual partner with the ideas that come from the ground.
Well, I think there's a good deal of wisdom in what you say, especially about having to see things multifactorial, but I did make the statement, and I stand behind it, that I think a lot of the problems we have now with ISIS had to do with our policy in Iraq, not singularly, but to a great deal, not only in terms of the war, but in the aftermath when Sunnis were not allowed really to share in the government provenance and so forth. But I want to go to some more of our listener emails. Shane writes, Seth Jones, based on the definition of terrorism, shouldn't we redefine the years of black lynching in the South as domestic terrorism? And another email along those lines from Thomas, who says, I find it odd that we will gladly label a Muslim leaning individual as a terrorist under many circumstances. He wasn't Muslim leaning, by the way. He was a devout Muslim. But Thomas goes on to write, however, a person promoting a referendum in California that suggests the state of California be required to kill all gays is allowed to go ahead and get signatures for such a radicalized action. And only months later is a judge ruling on this placement on the ballot. No pundit, no politician, no huge outcry. Frankly, nobody called this terrorism or labeled this person a terrorist. Why not? What in the world is going on?
Well, look, there have been, as we noted early on in this discussion, there have been a lot of debates over the last couple of decades and more about the definition of terrorism. We will not solve that here, and will not solve it in general. Again, I would come back to some things that have been in most people's definitions, including databases that have been used, that the violence or threat of violence generally has political aims or motives. There are psychological repercussions beyond the immediate victim or target. I don't think we need to agree on one definition, because we won't. But I will say, even if you look at some of the primary sources that have collected terrorism attacks in the U.S., even over the past several decades, as well as overseas, you'll get a number of these kinds of incidents in them if they meet the standard definition. So, again, I think virtually every major terrorist data set that one looks at, it's not about Islamic extremism. It's not only Islamic extremists here. There are plenty of far-right, far-left, and ethnic nationalist groups in there. So it may be the case that that some media outlets or some politicians are focusing on certain religions as doing this as opposed to others. But I would say if you look at some of the cold analytical work that's been done on terrorism, it's much broader than just religious issues, and that's been the case in the United States.
Well, doesn't it seem logical to some degree if somebody goes into a home invasion and shoots the people there and so forth? That's a kind of domestic terrorism, really, isn't it? It may not be totally political.
I think the issue, frankly, comes down to what are the political aims and motives. I mean, down in South Carolina, there was a manifesto. Anybody who read that manifesto, there was a very significant, if misguided certainly, but significant political motivation for a long-term vision of the United States. It was wrong, but it was a political motivation. That means that attack, I think most people who've looked at terrorism historically would code that as a terrorist attack.
Let me just go back for a moment to you, Faisal Patel, if I could. And I didn't want to leave this in the lurch. I had brought up also the question about arming those at, for example, a Naval Reserve Center. And there are really thousands who now federally are prohibited from being armed or from having firearms. And I'd like to get your take on that. I mean, there are many, as I say, a number of governors now who have moved forward against that.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think that the solution to gun violence is more guns, to be quite honest. It seems that if I were to look at the pattern of mass shootings, and let's just put it in that bucket for now, across the last several years where we've had these really horrific incidents where many, many kids or other civilians have been shot to death by people who were able to acquire guns more easily, my instinct would be, well, we should make it harder for people to get guns rather than arming more people, because I think statistically, the more guns you have in a society, the greater your level of violence is going to be. And certainly when you contrast, you know, violence levels in the United States versus countries in Europe where they have very strict gun control laws, you find that, you know, violence is far, far lower there than it is here. So that would be my instinct in terms of responding to gun violence.
All right, let me bring more callers on. And Charles, thank you for waiting. Join us on Forum. You're on the air.
Excellent program, Michael. And I agree with your comments regarding the United States activity in Iraq. I'll just cut to the chase and ask, are there any sort of forums, meetings within the Bay Area where, as your one guest pointed out, the answers are going to have to come from the grassroots level up? Are there any sort of opportunities here in the Bay Area for the average citizen to participate in this whole discussion?
I'm glad you raised that question, Charles. We'll put it out there, and if someone has a response or some information, please put it on our website, kqed.org/forum. And when we come to the end of this program, by the way, you can, of course, continue this discussion on our website, kqed.org/forum. Let me bring another caller on. In the meantime, though, Callum, good morning. You're on the air.
Good morning.
Kalim, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Yeah. thank you for having me. I simply wanted to comment that on the point of trying to identify the root cause of extremism, specifically Islamic extremism, as a Muslim myself and speaking on behalf of maybe not all the Muslims, but you know some of the modern Muslims, I think the biggest cause, just for the simplicity of conversation, for the sake of time, is the fact that to me it comes down to what we do as a nation, our foreign policy, the things that we have been involved in, the things that we've played a role in for the longest period of time. If you look at history, what has happened to the nation of Palestine and the role of Israel and the unconditional support that the U.S. has provided to Israel. If you look at the invasion of Iraq, if you look at Libya now, where we went in there with a certain set of expectations, and Libya, instead of being a better place, it's turned 10 times worse. So with some of the guests pointing out that I think the issue or the root cause is more fundamental, where it could be somebody misinterpreting some verses of the Quran or maybe other fundamental problems. I would say the majority of the extreme cases are associated with not only the U.S., but other countries in their position and their support of the causes or the situations that are created, which ends up being hurting Muslims around the world.
Well, there it is again, the argument, Farah Pandit, that the United States foreign policy is really largely to blame. We have, however, people like Bobby Jindal, who said publicly just recently in the wake of this tragedy we've been talking about, that radical Islam is at war with the United States. So we have, you know, completely contradictory points of view here, depending on who's presenting their point of view.
Well, look, this is not a new debate. This is a conversation we have had ever since 9/11 in our country about the, quote, root causes, unquote, of this kind of extremism that's inspired by Al-Qaeda and now ISIS and other groups like it. Why somebody joins Boko Haram or somebody joins Al-Shabaab is around narratives that the bad guys use that is based on an us and them mentality. And when they are trying to seduce young kids to go in a particular direction, everything fits into this us and them framework. So they will use foreign policy. They will use other things to jump in and make their case.
We got seconds left, and Faisal, you wanted in here.
Yeah. Right, but here's the thing, right? Is that going to work unless there's a fundamental issue that's underlying it? So if there was no foreign policy grievance, or if there wasn't some other grievance, would the ideology resonate with people? And I think that's the key question.
Okay, we're going to have to leave it there because we come to the end of this hour. I want to thank all our guests. Thanks to Faisal Patel and Farah Pandit and Seth Jones and also Rabbit Zilke, whom we spoke to earlier from Chattanooga. And we thank you, our listeners. Again, you can continue this discussion online going to kqed.org/forum. When we return, our guest will be Philip Zimbardo, new film about that famed experiment that went on back in 1971 with students being prisoners and guards. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio, the Germanicos Foundation, and the Generosity Foundation, and by a generous gift from Jan Schremm and Maria Minetti Schremm, founders of Clos Pegas Winery, who believe that all people deserve access to education, information, and culture for a lifetime of exploration and learning.